Today is February 15th, 2012. My name is Joey Beauchamp, a graduate student here at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Luker Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Jim Van Boven over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Jim, I apologize. I should have probably asked how to pronounce your last name. Was that correct?
Yeah, I'm impressed. You got it right on the first try.
All right, good deal. I was going to ask you about that because my last name some people have difficulty with. So.
Uh-huh.
All right, well, good. I'm glad I got that right. All right, so let's just start with your background, you know, where you grew up, where you were born, you know, how you got involved in athletics and cycling, I guess, and that was your main sport, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm a native-born Californian. And I grew up in a lot of different places. My dad was in the military, and so we traveled around. I lived in various places in California, Air Force bases, until I was four, and then we moved to Panama, then Panama for till I was seven. And then we were outside of Philadelphia when I was eight. We were in Dayton, Ohio, until I was 12, and then when we moved out to the Bay Area in, I think it was 62,
uh-huh.
And that's when I started riding a bike a lot, because we lived in this kind of upscale community, and I was always used to there being kids across the street to play with, but in this community, everything was really spread out, and I got to know kids through school, but the only way to get over to their houses is to ride my bike, and it was very hilly. So.
Yeah, I was going to say the Bay Area is pretty hilly there.
Yeah, we were in Hillsboro, which is near San Mateo, where my dad grew up.
Uh-huh.
And so aptly named Hillsboro is where I started riding a lot. And, you know, then I... Just by chance, I didn't know anything about bike racing. I just met a guy in a bike shop, and he was talking to me about it. It sounded kind of interesting, and he had some friend who was a president of a bike club. And so I met this kid, and he was a 15-year-old kid with pimples all over his face, but he was all jacked up about cycling and
uh-huh.
racing. And so, you know, I had never really done anything competitive up until that point. And so he kind of got me into it. And I developed very rapidly. I didn't realize that I had an athletic talent, although my father was a track and field star when he was in high school. So I very rapidly moved up in the ranks. And I was actually surprised when I made the Olympic team. I really didn't ever expect to get that far, but, you know, it was, for whatever reason, I was just really performing well there.
So when you were, that was your main focus growing up then of sports, was the cycling, and was it through a club, or how did you do that?
Well, yeah, I was in this club called the Belmont Bicycle Club, and actually I went to Europe with two friends. And these guys wanted to get some bikes. We flew to Paris, and these guys were going down to Italy to buy some bikes. And this was in 1966. And I took my bike over there, and I wound up riding my bike to Italy. And I rode around Switzerland and rode a number of the mountain passes and really fell in love with cycling. And when I got back, I rode my first road race and... got a sixth place, which was, you know, I was very satisfied with that. It was only the second bike race I'd ever been in.
About how old were you about that time?
So I was 16 at the time.
Yeah, I thought I was reading that you were pretty young when you actually made the Olympic team, so I'm guessing.
Yeah, I was 18 when I made the team, and I was the youngest guy on the cycling team.
Right.
And all the other guys seemed much more experienced and older than me. I just completed my freshman year of college when I made the team.
So back during that early time period, you were in your high school days then, and you were just competing through local races, or how did that go?
Yeah, there's a Northern California district that I was competing in, and I was what's called a junior rider. I was under 18, and my first big break was I was in the state championships, and I had some bad luck. I got a flat tire, and so I wound up getting sixth place, and they were going to take the top three riders to the Nationals. And the top two riders went, but the third-place guy didn't feel like going. And then the fourth-place guy didn't want to go, and the fifth-place guy wasn't going to go, so they said that I could go.
Well, that worked out well.
So just, you know, by this fluke, I was able to compete in the Nationals, which I won as a junior. And so that was kind of my first big break. You know, and I'd kind of gone from... I'd been racing at that point for about a year, so I'd gone from being a complete novice to being the best junior rider in the country as a road rider.
Uh-huh.
And then you know, I turned 18 and was a senior, and so, you know, I didn't expect to do well against these guys because they're much more older and experienced. But I did place well in some races, and this gave me hope, so... the way they did the Olympic trials for this particular year, this Olympics and in cycling, is they had two 110-mile road races outside of L.A. and out of Orgora. And they were taking the top four riders in each race for a total of eight that would be qualified for the Olympic team, the Olympic road team. The track team had a different schedule.
Right.
You know, it was all on the track, and I don't remember exactly how many riders they took. I think it was something like maybe 10 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
A different kind of events. And then the two teams were combined. You know, we went down, the combined cycling team went down to Mexico together.
Right.
But anyway, I got second on the first day of the trials. So, you know, I was second ranked in the Olympic trials. So I made the team, and I was really thrilled and quite happy to be able to go to the Olympics. I just never dreamed that I would do something like that.
Right.
That was actually kind of a... When I was in school, I was... You know, as a young kid growing up, I wasn't that much into sports, at least the team sports that were played in school.
Uh-huh.
You know, like in a baseball game, you know, I'd be one of the last guys picked, and, you know, I just wasn't that interested in, and wasn't particularly talented either.
Yeah. I was going to ask a little bit about that. I remember when I was growing up in Reno, Greg LeMond was kind of the big thing in mm-hmm. cycling, but even then it was such a... unique sport that not too many people really knew about it and followed it.
Yeah.
And, so how was that even further back a little bit before his time? You know, I'm sure it wasn't a huge sport back then either.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was really the dark ages. It was just a total fringe kind of sport. And it attracted a lot of kind of interesting people, however. And, you know, I'm still in touch with a lot of people from back in those days. They tend to be kind of bohemian, countercultural types.
Yeah.
I remember some of the first computer programmers were people who, these were guys who were doing stuff with computers in the late 60s, you know,
uh-huh.
when it was just a really different world. It was all mainframes and punch cards. And
right.
But yet, you know, some of these guys, I heard them talk about computers, and I just couldn't imagine what that was. You know?
Uh-huh.
It was like something you used to... You know, conduct a military offensive or something.
Right. Now, you, I think I read somewhere you were at San Jose State about this time, too. Was that the same time frame?
Yeah.
So you had started college by this time?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I won the nationals in the summer after I graduated from high school, and then I moved out of my folks' home 50 miles down to San Jose and started in San Jose.
Uh-huh.
And I went there for 4.5 years till I got my undergraduate degree.
Right. Now, it's obviously part of 1968 is, you know, the time period, I guess, is pretty tumultuous with all the things going on in the world.
Yeah.
San Jose State, I think I read Harry Edwards was there at that time. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember him being around or any of the track team? I think the two gentlemen from Tommy Smith and...
Well, there was a number of gold medalists.
Juan Carlos, were they part of the San Jose team, or were they just in the area?
No, they went to San Jose State. They were students there, and I don't know what they were in, some kind of running club.
Uh huh.
So I don't know exactly what their official affiliation was. If it was through a club or through the school. I know the 440 relay team had. They won a gold medal. It was Ronnie Ray Smith and Lee Evans and Tommy Carlos.
Right.
I think, and I can't remember the fourth guy.
So at this point, before the Olympics, and you're still a freshman on campus, I imagine, was there anything going on campus that you were aware of as far as, you know, these organized protests at this time or anything like the Human Rights
Project
and stuff?
There was some stuff going on. You know, I wouldn't describe myself as a political activist, but uh-huh. I sort of was caught up in the countercultural mood of rebellion.
Uh-huh.
I was sympathetic to the protests. And but funny enough, I mean, the only time I ever got tear gassed was one time I was going to my volleyball class, my PE class,
uh-huh.
and I was coming out on the court, and I saw this tear gas canister go flying overhead, and then it exploded, and we all had to get off the court. I mean, we weren't protesting or anything. We were just trying to...
Innocent bystanders.
...play a game, you know, as part of our studies. And, you know, it was events like that that I think weren't favorable towards the authorities.
Right. Okay, so you make the Olympic team, and then how do they... start your training for that, or, you know, because obviously in Mexico City the concerns were the altitude. Were they trying to prepare you guys in any way? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody knew it would be a big deal, and so we went down to Mexico soon after the trials, and we were there for a long, long time before the games began. I mean, at least 6 weeks. So there's a really a long time to acclimatize and, you know, get used to the altitude and all the other. I don't think all of the teams did that, but nearly all the cycling teams did.
Uh huh.
And so, one of the key parts of the training were they would have these local races, you know, that the Mexican cyclists were riding.
Uh huh.
But the difference was all the national teams for the Olympics were there. So these guys would show up, plus, you know, all the Mexicans who would usually be racing. And so you get these huge packs of, like, you know, 300 or 400 riders. And the races were very aggressive because it was sort of a, you know, way, you know, for the athletes, the Olympic athletes, it wasn't so much about trying to win the race as just training.
Uh-huh.
So one thing that really sticks in my mind is the first race I rode that was like this, and it was sort of an out and back deal, and I think the race was a little over 100 miles, and so our team showed up there, and the gun went off, and the race went up this, you know, maybe half mile, three quarter mile hill, and guys were just sprinting out of the saddle, just going like it was the last, you know, wind up, you know, the last kilometer of a race.
Uh-huh.
They were going that hard from the beginning, and in fact, the winning breakaway was launched in the first mile. You know, these guys went away. Some Italians led out by their own track team, and they were never seen again.
Oh,
and it was just really stunning.
Uh-huh.
you know. And I was, you know, because I had improved so rapidly when I was first started the sport, I had a lot of self-confidence, and you know, I think I really overestimated my abilities in terms of being able to compete on an international level. I mean, of course, I'd heard about how good the Europeans were, but you know, I had no idea how good they were relative to us.
So
and,
that was
they
that...
were what I found out in that first race was, yeah, they were way better than us. So it was a real sobering experience.
Right. So that's your first experience with that, and then
that was the first international race I had ridden.
Did that? I guess you're alluding to this anyway, but was your confidence kind of shaken at that point for the Olympics, or what were you thinking?
Well, I mean, I was just happy to be able to compete in the Olympics. So, you know, I think I was more just evaluating myself in relationship to my other teammates and how they were going, and also like Canadians or, you know, other countries that were more on our level. I mean, it was clear that we weren't going to be able to challenge for a medal, you know, based upon what I saw there. So, I mean, that was a little bit of a letdown, but, you know, I was able to accept that without too much problem.
Right. So do you feel that going down early got you guys ready for that altitude? You were pretty cool with it when the racing really started?
Yeah, I mean, we were really, there was a great team spirit. Everybody was really psyched up. And I'll never forget the first day we got there. You know, all the guys wanted to go riding immediately. You know, we'd just gotten off the plane. We'd gone out to the village and, you know, moved into our quarters, and immediately everybody wanted to ride. But our bikes were, there was some problem getting access to the bikes, or they hadn't shown up yet, but they, you know, we finally did get them. And, you know, just, I mean, this wasn't anything that was organized through coaches or anything. It was just a spontaneous thing. And so the combined road and track teams just jumped on our bikes, and we just tore off, you know, all around the town. I don't know where we were going, but we're all going like bats out of hell. And, you know, a couple guys almost got hit by cars, you know, because the cars run through red lights there, and we were running through red lights. But,
right.
You know, it was just one of these really exciting, spontaneous things. And so, you know, morale was just super high.
Well, it's kind of a good point to ask this, I guess, but what were your impressions of the locals and the Mexico City? And you mentioned the quarters you were in, you know, what the Olympic Village was like. I mean, what were some of your impressions of, like, I guess, the local culture? Did you get to know very many people or even talk to the locals?
No, I didn't really meet any well, let me take that back. Later on, I remember going to at least one party where I met some locals.
Mm-hmm.
And we were hoping to pick up some girls, but we didn't.
Yeah.
You know, hoping that our being able to say we're, you know, in the Olympics and we wear a little Olympic pen or something, that might improve our chances, but I wasn't much of a ladies' man at that point anyway. So, but anyway, I did meet some people that way.
So what about, you mentioned you guys got there early enough to check into the Olympic Village. Is that what you're referring to with your rooms?
Yeah. It consisted of a series of high-rises.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly enough, about a year ago, I was in Mexico City with my wife, and I was curious to go back out there and see what it looked like. And, you know, we were staying in Mexico City up by the main square.
Uh-huh.
So we took local transportation south, and I still had my original map from the Olympics.
Wow.
You know, it showed where the village was, and there is actually a metro stop, or I think it's a bus stop. Yeah, they have, like, this system of buses that goes there. And so we got off, and the place is now a gated community, although it was gated, of course, when we were there at the Olympics, too.
Right.
And but I was able to talk my way in. I just told them I knew somebody in there and gave them my passport, and we went in. And I couldn't remember if we were in Building 13 on Floor 9 or if we were on building 9, floor 13.
Right.
Those two numbers seem to stick in my mind.
Uh-huh.
And the buildings looked exactly the same as I remembered them from, you know, all that time, a long time ago.
Right.
There were these high rises, and, you know, the whole plan was that it would be turned over to public housing after the games, which I think was a good thing. And so, you know, I was looking around, and, you know, I could just sort of imagine riding through there like I did for that long period. It must have been down. I think the games went on for about a month, and I was down there for a month and a half before. So we were really living there for 2.5 months. It was a pretty long time.
What were the accommodations like as far as how many roommates did you have?
I think I had two roommates, John Howard and Dave Brink, were my roommates. And the road riders tended to sort of stick together as roommates, and the track riders were roommates. But, you know, everybody was kind of in the same area. So, you know, we'd see each other and talk. And the road riders tended to be a separate group from the track riders. But, you know, the cyclists tended to be together as opposed to the other teams.
Uh-huh.
You know, the runners or the swimmers. I mean, I didn't know many people on other teams very much. You know, I'd meet them occasionally, like in a cafeteria or on a bus. But we were pretty focused on training. And so, you know, we were usually training or we were recovering from training.
Right. Did you like the facilities for the events? I mean, did they, when you practiced, you guys were pretty much, I guess, out on the roads pretty much for your training, right?
Right.
And so we'll get into this eventually, but I'm guessing your event then, they just had a road course picked out somewhere outside the city then?
Well, I was selected to ride the road race.
Okay.
And I was doing well in training, so, you know, I was told that they wanted me to, I think they were going to select four riders to ride the road race, and so I was definitely already picked for that.
Okay.
But I was also riding so strongly, they said, well, we think we'd like you to also ride the 100-kilometer team time trial, which is a four-rider group in addition to the road race. So I said, fine. And the 100K was first up, or it was before the road race. Well, actually, I think both events were held in the same place. It was basically there's a freeway that runs around Mexico City, and it existed back then and still does. And they closed off a good section of this freeway to traffic, and then the events were held on the freeway.
Okay.
Of course, the freeway in Mexico isn't quite the same thing as here.
Right.
You know, it's a little bit more accessible, and, you know, doesn't necessarily have a fence along the entire length of it.
Gotcha.
So people could, you know, they could see it. And
before we get to the opening ceremonies then, you were down early enough. Were you guys aware of all the protesting by the local students and the massacre that had happened prior to the games?
You know, I've got an interesting story for you. And
okay.
It relates to this first race that I was just telling you about.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that this massacre, what's the name of it? The something?
Tlatelolco, local?
Yeah.
Tlatelolco?
I think that might have occurred.
I should probably not pronounce that.
Right at the place where our race was supposed to start. Because we went out to start this race, and there were like these smoking buses and stuff. I mean, obviously something really bad had gone on.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, apparently it was suppressed, or it was really toned down. I mean, I've read official accounts of it since then.
Uh-huh.
Apparently it was a pretty big cover-up and, you know, competing theories about what happened. But, yeah, it was just a horrible thing that had gone on. And, you know, everybody, you know, we didn't know exactly what had happened.
And that was right where
it wasn't in the media.
And you guys were, that's where you were holding your race that day?
Yeah, it was right at the starting point.
Wow.
So it was pretty weird. But, you know, I think the general feeling for me and most of the other guys was that, man, there's really something wrong here, you know, if this is going on, you know. We felt like there was some sort of corruption happening, you know.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, people felt that they needed to protest and that this is what had happened is pretty serious.
Yeah.
We didn't know what people were protesting exactly about or anything or the extent of it. But, yeah, it was definitely noticed and talked about.
Yeah. In the Olympics, obviously, you know, protests are going to become important later on. Was anything going on at that time? Had anybody been organizing anything at that point? I'm thinking
about... Well, one thing that happened, and this is another thing that really stands out, is, and I don't remember the timing on this.
It was probably
during the games, and my guess is that it probably happened after Lee Edwards and a couple other guys had done the Black Power salute and were stripped of their medals. Somebody put up a big sign, said "Down with Brundage," you know, Avery Brundage,
right,
chairman of the IOC. They hung it off of one of the dorms. It wasn't our dorm, but it was one of the other dorms. It was a huge sign, and you know, the authorities were furious and wanted to find out who did this. And I didn't know who did it, but I felt good about it. I thought it was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we just felt like the IOC was kind of playing along with the Mexican government, and you know.
So up until this point, you weren't aware that they were even going to plan something like their protests at the track events or anything like that?
No.
No.
Okay. No, that was a complete surprise.
Right.
And when it happened, I felt okay about it. I thought it was okay for them to do that.
Right. Okay.
I don't know if I would have the same take now, but...
Yeah. Well, so back to a little bit to the accommodations again, the food situation, everything was good for you guys in training, and you guys, there was no problems with food or anything like that?
Well, the food was all supposed to be, you know, safe so you wouldn't get sick.
Uh-huh.
But I actually wound up getting really sick.
Uh-oh.
And it was after I competed in the 100K,
uh-huh,
which I really blew myself out in that event. And, you know, it goes on for, like, you know, over 2 hours. It's a long distance. So
uh-huh,
you're putting out your maximum for two and a half hours.
Right.
And after that, I got violently ill. Actually, so ill that my weight dropped to 110 pounds, and I couldn't ride my event, the road race.
Bummer.
Because I was too sick. So I was pretty bummed about that.
Yeah, I bet.
And so, yeah, I think the food wasn't 100%
yeah,
pure, although, you know, not everybody got sick, you know.
Right.
I think I just got sick because my resistance got really lowered,
uh-huh,
after this huge output. It's sort of a combination of the two.
Okay.
But in general, the food seemed okay to me.
Okay, good. All right, so you guys have been training for a while, and now it's time the Olympics start, opening ceremonies. Did you get to be part of that?
Yeah. Let me just say one thing about the training.
Uh-huh.
We spent a lot of time writing circular pace lines for the 100K. That's kind of I think it still is considered to be the most efficient way to ride that kind of an event.
Is that where the front guy goes to the back and they take turns leading and stuff like that?
Yeah,
okay.
You're only on the front for a very short amount of time.
Uh-huh.
And when you pull off, you know, the guy who's in back of you goes by you, but, you know, not too fast. And then almost as soon as he's by you, he pulls off. And so you can actually draft the guy who is in back of you as you're going back. Now he's in front of you.
Right.
And it's just this whole ballet, which is, it's really beautiful when you get it synchronized.
I bet.
And, you know.
And tricky.
It's all about being able to keep it smooth when you're right on the edge of what you can do, you know.
Right. And then going around corners and stuff, I'm sure.
And then they're going around corners and changing up speed, you know, when you hit an uphill section.
Uh-huh.
We actually had, I think we had about 8 miles of climbing in our event. It was, this freeway actually had a lot up and down to it.
Uh-huh.
Generally, it's usually a flat course. So, you know, we had to take that into account.
Yeah. Okay, so the opening ceremonies,
Well, the opening ceremonies, I remember being on the bus and going there, and everybody's kind of keyed up, and I was talking to a swimmer. I don't know. It was either Mark Spitz or Don Scholander, and I asked him what. I mean, there were a lot of guys like that who, you know, were multiple medal winners from other Olympics, who, you know, are pretty famous people. But, you know, I wouldn't recognize these people. You know, I'd just meet them in a cafeteria or, like, you know, be on the bus and ask them, what sport are you doing? And they'll say something like swimming and, oh, what's your name, Mark Spitz? And go, oh, yeah, didn't you win some medals? And go, yeah, you know, I won 8 medals. So it was kind of exciting to meet those kind of caliber of person just, you know, on a casual basis and, you know, be associated through the team. And so, yeah, I met one of these swimmers. And then when we marched into the stadium, it was just like, you know, oh, my God, this is really quite an honor. I think everybody felt a sense of awe. It's just something that you you don't get until you reach that level, and you know, to come into a stadium with such a large crowd cheering, and it really is something you just never forget.
And what was the reception like for the U.S. when you came in? Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember it as being any different for any other team.
Right. Okay.
You know, everybody was very enthusiastic. And
did anybody from your family get to go down?
No, nobody from my family was there.
Okay. So let's go to your event then. When did that take place? Was that pretty close to the opening ceremonies, or how did that?
No, it was. I think maybe halfway through the games or something.
Did you get to go do a lot of watching of other events and things then?
Not really. I was pretty focused on training.
Okay.
And I did see some of the track events, bicycle track events. And that was pretty exciting because of the altitude. All the world records were being shattered.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to go out and see this happen. And these times were just unbelievable. You know, guys were, I remember in a qualifying race, the Italians had ridden 4 minutes and 10 seconds for 4,000 meters, which is, that's just a phenomenal time and phenomenal speed. It just had never been even come close to that.
Right.
You know, these weren't, you know, the times were falling by a matter of, like 5 and 10 seconds. It wasn't like fractions of a second or 1 or 2 seconds. It was big stuff. So that was very exciting.
And so you were actually getting to witness a lot of those. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't think I actually saw any other events live. I mean, I saw some stuff on TV. But I didn't see any of the other events. I would just hear about them.
Okay, so the day of your event, you want to take us through that, how things transpired?
Yeah, well, that's a pretty interesting story, too, because what happened was we went out and we were coming to the start line, and the way they do this is the teams go off at 2-minute intervals. So every 2 minutes, a team would go off, and there was a total of 30 teams. And I don't remember where we were in the lineup. I think we're in the last half. No, we might have been in the first half. Maybe somewhere in the middle. And just as we were getting ready to go off, a guy committed suicide.
Wow.
It was right. I didn't actually see it happen. I don't even think I heard the gun go off. But immediately, there were all these Army guys, and they sort of just crowded around, you know, and shooed everybody away, and, you know, he was whisked away. And I had this feeling like, you know, what was this about? I mean, was this a protest, you know, having to do with the United States government, or is this just a random person who is despondent and just decided to end his life in this way? I didn't know what to think.
Right.
But it was pretty unsettling in terms of getting ready to ride your event in the Olympics.
Yeah, I was going to say
that. Have some guy blow his brains out, you know, just right before you're going to take off, you know.
Yeah, it might disrupt your focus, I could imagine.
Yeah. Although, you know, once we were underway, you know, it was just completely, I was just completely focused on the event.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, if during the event itself it flashed into your head at all about that.
No, not at all.
You were pretty good about focusing. That's
yeah.
Good. Okay, so how did the event go? How did you guys, I think you mentioned earlier you weren't too happy, or what was that? How, your performance?
Well, I was okay with our performance.
Okay.
Shortly into the event, our time was around 2 hours and 25 minutes, and which unfortunately just missed the national record. I think we would have broken the national record, but the actual course turned out it was a little bit longer than 100 kilometers.
Uh-huh.
And then we also had 8 miles of climbing, which certainly slowed things down. So I actually realized that we had probably set the fastest 100K time of any team in U.S. history up to that point. So,
good.
I felt pretty good about that. One of the riders was a lot weaker than the other three of us, and he wasn't able to take poles at the front. And so the team coach made a call to say that you guys need to slow down so that, you know, he doesn't get dropped, because he might not be feeling good right now, but he might be able to help you guys later on. So just maintain a pace where he can hang in there, and don't, you know, there's a way you can do the circular pace line so somebody doesn't take pulls. You know, they don't
right.
go through the rotation. They just kind of hang on the back.
So if you had dropped him, does he have to cross the finish line with you guys?
No, they take the time of the third rider.
Wow, so that may have...
So, I mean, we could have jettisoned him at that point, but it was a feeling that, you know, it was so early on, you know, we didn't want to commit to losing his potential horsepower, you know.
Right.
If he's not feeling good, maybe he could come around. And
uh-huh.
So I think it was probably a good call. But we got caught and passed by the East German team, which was 2 minutes in back of us, quite soon. I think we had only covered maybe 10 or 15 miles, and they went wailing past us. And that was really demoralizing.
I was going to say that probably was.
And so at that point we knew, you know, that we were not setting any kind of contentious pace.
Uh-huh.
But also we felt frustrated that we were actually, because we weren't even going full out, because we didn't want to drop our fourth guy.
Uh-huh.
At that point, the coaches then said, well, you guys can go on, and, you know, he's just going to have to drop off. We'll just take the third guy's time. So at that point, we went on ahead, and then that's the way it was for most of the rest of the way. I made a terrible mistake in this thing, because I was thinking about this whole event is like a much shorter time trial. I'd ridden, you know, like 10-mile time trials and
uh-huh.
you know, shorter distances where you really cannot eat anything, because you're just your breathing is so heavy, and you know, you just don't have time to eat. And so I was thinking it was going to be like that, so I didn't take any food. All I took was like a little vial of sugar.
Right.
I mean, things were so primitive back then, and nobody counseled me on, you know, how, you know, what to take or what not to take. So I took my little vial of sugar, and then towards the end I started getting really tired because I hadn't eaten.
Uh-huh.
And you just need to eat when you go for that long, and I didn't have anything, and none of the other guys had anything.
Yeah, that's
so.
Towards the end, I
knew that I was going to be the slowest guy of the three of us, and one guy, who John Howard, who became a good friend, was doing a lot of the hard work, and then right towards the end, the other guy, John Ellis, did this terrific pull and just pulled for like the last kilometer or so, and we just hung on. And so, you know, we all gave everything we could.
Right.
And everybody felt good about everybody else, you know, the three of us.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Everybody felt good with each other.
Yeah.
That everybody, yeah, that's good then.
I mean, I felt a little bit bad for myself, about myself, that I felt like I'd let them down a little bit. Like if I had been more careful about thinking about, you know, what I should have taken to eat, I think I could have contributed more and getting us a little better time. Probably the best thing about it was is we caught and passed the Canadian team, which is our that was our competition. We caught them about 5 miles before the end, and they were really surprised that we had caught them, because, you know, with 2 minutes, that's a pretty big amount of time. And traditionally U.S. and Canadian riders are pretty evenly matched, but so we had caught them, and then we were going by them, and so they put in this big effort to catch us, and or at least hold us off, and their team split in two with two riders each. So we totally demoralized them, and they had to regroup because, you know, with two riders, they couldn't finish. So.
And you guys only had three. Does that make it worse then, that only three guys could pass them? Were they, you know, was that more demoralizing to have a team of three pass you or four?
Well, probably more demoralizing than three going by.
Yeah.
But the fact that it was the U.S. too, you know.
Yeah.
We knew who we were competing against, so.
Yeah.
We knew we weren't going to beat the Europeans, but, you know, so we were just competing against our natural competitors. And I think our time got us a 20th place out of 30 teams.
I think you're right on that. I think I read it was 20th, yeah.
And, but surprisingly, though, like France, I think, was only 5 minutes ahead of us. I think they got 12th place or something.
Right.
And the Dutch won the time trial at a fantastic time. They were almost 20 minutes faster than us. And I remember I met I don't think it was a cyclist, but it was somebody from the Dutch team, and I traded him a USA T-shirt for a Dutch warm-up jersey, which I still have.
Uh-huh.
And since my last name is Dutch, you know, I just thought this was kind of cool.
Yeah. I thought I read somewhere that one of the teams higher up had all brothers on the team. All four were brothers.
That was the Peterson brothers.
Yeah.
I think they might have gotten second place.
Uh-huh.
They did a fantastic ride, and I think the Italians were third.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, those three teams were really, really good. And the Mexicans, I think, got fifth place.
Wow.
But there was a lot of allegations that they had cheated, that they had, you know, that they were using drugs, that they had followed our team car. They were drafting the vehicles.
The car.
So it was a very suspect result.
Right. Well, since you brought it up, what with drug testing happened in those Olympics that you can remember? I know that they had introduced gender testing and a little bit of for performance-enhancing drugs at that time. They were just barely starting. Do you guys remember any of that? Did they test you guys?
I never got tested, and I don't know anybody on the cycling team who got tested.
Okay.
I mean, it was weird. Because, I mean, it's nothing like it is now.
Right.
First of all, the technology wasn't there.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was way before EPO.
Right.
You know, which really works.
Yeah.
Like, people do it.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it was just kind of this thing that was off in the distance. But one thing I will tell you is, I remember talking with one of the track riders, and, you know, this guy was an older guy, and, you know, he'd really been around, a sophisticated guy, and, you know, I'm just this naive kid, and, you know, he told me that he took steroids.
Uh-huh.
And I might be wrong about this, but I don't think it was illegal to take steroids back then.
Right.
And he didn't think anything of it, because a lot of the track guys, they did upper body workouts in addition to the regular cycling.
Right.
Because their events are so short, and particularly for sprinters, they need this explosive power. And so their upper bodies are you know, quite well developed, much more than a road cyclist.
Uh-huh.
And so they work out in the gyms, and a lot of these guys are from L.A. And so apparently this was common in the gym culture in L.A. at this time.
Right.
You know, to take the steroids. And so they had just kind of picked up on it that way. And it was just considered just, you know, part of, you know, what you would do.
Right, came with the territory kind of thing, yeah.
And I also remember being somewhat shocked when he showed me a picture of his wife. You know, here's my wife, and he showed me another picture. This is my kids, and he didn't show me another picture. This is my girlfriend.
Oh,
you know, it's just like, what? You have a girlfriend and you're married?
You're married, yeah.
I didn't say that, but it was just like, I was a naive kid, you know?
Right. Do you know offhand, I thought I read this, but was there anybody younger on the U.S. team that year? I thought you were the youngest that year.
Well, I was the youngest in the cycling team. I mean, there was younger.
Was it the swimmers,
the
gymnastics, yeah.
Were quite a bit younger. Some of the girls were probably like 16.
Right. Did you ever get to interact with any of those fellow teammates?
No, I never knew them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you pretty much hung out with the cycling team most of the time?
Yeah, because we're training together and we're recovering from training together and we just tended to pal around together.
Right.
I got to be good friends with John Howard.
Uh-huh.
No, we were roommates, and I'd met him at the trials, and we just kind of had the same sort of temperament and commitment.
Right.
And then also Dave Brink was another roommate, and we didn't get to know each other that well at that time, but we actually see each other occasionally. Because we get together once a year, we do a bike ride. There's a whole bunch of riders from Northern California. We call ourselves the Old Farts, and we get together and do a bike ride and a barbecue once a year. And so,
where do you guys
come out to that a number of times?
Where do you guys hold that?
Just various riders' houses.
Okay.
Anybody who has a big house that's, you know, near an area where we can do a nice ride.
Yeah, you know, I told you earlier I grew up in Reno, so I'm pretty familiar with most of Northern California, being down there a lot. So,
mm-hmm.
Is that what you're referring to? Is that area like Sacramento? Or...
Yeah, I live in Berkeley now.
Gotcha.
I've been in Berkeley for about 30 years.
Gotcha.
But yeah, so it's the old stomping grounds.
Uh huh. And so
a lot of the guys are still living in the area. And a lot of them are still riding, too. So,
well, that's good for you guys.
It's been interesting,
yeah.
You know, just to know these people. In a way, I feel a lot closer to them than, say, going to a high school reunion.
Uh-huh.
I feel like these are more my people.
Right, right. Well, and you were at an age, too, where impressionable and looking up to these people, I imagine, a little bit.
Well, it made this whole period of cycling really had a big impact on my life. You know, it was really, I raced competitively for 7 years. When I graduated from college, that's when I quit cycling.
Uh-huh.
Because I wanted to really focus on graduate school. And I also had lost a lot of the desire to compete. So it was for a combination of those reasons I left the sport, and I've never been competitive in it since then. But I continue to ride.
Right.
I like to ride. I like to go for bike tours, and I like, you know, getting together with the old guys or just people who've taken up the sport in the last couple of years.
Do you think that's common with people who burn out at a young age because they get tired of it at an early age, being involved so much, or was that just unique for you at that time?
I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of competitive cyclists who burned out on the sport and just completely never went back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this feeling, this gut feeling that, like, if I kept doing this, that I was going to really hate it and not want to ride a bike anymore.
Right.
And I didn't want that to happen. Because for me, the whole thing that got me into it in the first place was I just loved riding a bike.
Right.
You know, I didn't do it because I wanted to make money or because I wanted glory or because of all these other reasons. I just did it because I liked riding the bike.
Mm-hmm. So after your event, how much time was left in the Olympics at that point? Do you remember it all, or?
Yeah, well, the 100K.
Because I remember you got sick and you couldn't do the
100K. Got sick, and then I, you know, it wasn't a whole lot longer, actually. I think maybe like 5 days or something like that.
Were you bedridden because of the illness, or?
I was for a little while. I might have been well enough to go watch. I think I was well enough to go watch the road race.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of a depressing experience.
Yeah.
I want to be in it.
Yeah. How do you think you? I mean, you can speculate forever on this, but what would you think of your chances if you were healthy at that point? You saw the results, and I'm sure, and talked to people about it. How do you think you may have done?
Well, I suspect based on the other races that I rode in, there were a number of them, like I've described, we'll call them pre-Olympic races, based on that. And then also I rode the World Championships in 1971. I doubt if I would have finished the race.
Wow.
I doubt if, you know, because once you get pretty far behind, they'll pull you out. Nobody in the U.S. team finished the race except for John Howard, and I think he got like 44th.
But
John Howard was riding at a different level than the rest of us. He was clearly a really strong rider, and he was still developing at that point. He had kind of burst on the scene, and, you know, he continued to improve. He never became a big star like Greg LeMond or Lance Armstrong, but he was the top cyclist of his day for a number of years. And
right.
He's managed to reinvent himself over the years. He won the Ironman Triathlon 1 year in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
He set a world speed record on bicycle. I don't know what else he's done, but
<That's>
he's still active in the sport.
Yeah.
I spoke to him a year or two ago, and it was a good talk on the phone.
Right. Okay, so the biggest event, I guess, memory-wise, as far as the media is concerned, was the protests at the track events. You mentioned you weren't there for that. The aftermath of all that, you mentioned the flag on the balcony.
Yeah, the banner.
Yeah, do you remember anything else about that, like media coverage or... I know some of the athletes have mentioned how crazy it got with the media all over the place, and
I don't remember that.
Yeah,
I actually don't remember that.
Okay.
I just remember there was this witch hunt to find out who had done it.
Oh, for the banner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what did they do for that witch hunt? Did they call you into an office and interrogate you guys,
no,
or what?
It wasn't on our building, and
Nobody
in official capacity ever talked to me about it.
Gotcha.
It might have been just more like rumor or something. I was just hearing stuff.
So do you know what the general feeling was amongst the team, the U.S. Olympic team? Were they more supportive of that effort, or was it, you know, on an individual basis?
No, I think a lot of the people supported it.
Uh-huh.
That was my impression. People I knew, anyway.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, there were some people who thought it was disgusting and, you know, they had no right to do that, but I would say the vast majority thought it was appropriate.
Okay. Before I talk about the closing ceremonies, was there anything else about the Olympic experience that you can remember you want to share?
Well, one thing I would like to say, although it doesn't necessarily pertain to the Olympic experience per se, is I really liked Mexico.
Okay.
I'd never been there when we went down. I'd never been out of the country except I'd been to Europe 2 years before. I was, riding my bike around.
Right.
But this experience of another country was really interesting. And then the experience of Mexico, which, you know, was a lot less developed back then, that was really fascinating to me. And I think it started sort of a lifelong interest in travel. I've done quite a bit of traveling in my life, and many times to Latin America and South America and Mexico. Probably been to Mexico at least a dozen times.
I don't know if you mentioned this earlier. Did you get to do any sightseeing there, or were you pretty much focused on the event?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. No, I really didn't do sightseeing when I was there. And so in the times that I've gone back, it was sort of like, well, now I finally get to sightsee.
Gotcha, yeah.
Because I had heard about things, you know, but like I'd heard about these floating gardens and canals, which in Solchimico, which wasn't too far from where we were, but I never went there. You know, that whole 2.5 months I was there. I mean, I think some people did. If you were more motivated, you probably could have done it. But I was really focused on the training and recovery from training. And recovery, it just would be pretty listless.
I'm sure, yeah.
Just kind of lay around and and eat and relax, and it didn't feel like doing much.
Exactly. So closing ceremonies approach. It's the end of the Olympics. Did you get to participate in those ceremonies?
I did, although I actually can't remember much.
Uh-huh.
Main thing I remember is a bunch of us went out and we got drunk, and one of the guys, you know, was really wasted. I was really kind of amazed how wasted he had gotten, and that was it. That was the end of it. It was, you know, it was a bit of a letdown with it ending. And then when I got back, it was more of a letdown for me.
What?
I mean, my friends and people I knew were excited to see me again, had a lot of questions about what it was like, particularly cycling friends, you know, and guys in my club and stuff. But one thing that was a little bit different in my situation was that my family had moved away from the family home. They had moved to the Bahamas. And so I went out there because school wasn't starting up for another 2 months. They wanted me to come out to the Bahamas to be with them, so I did. But I felt very isolated there, and I was just kind of at a point in my life where I really didn't want to be around my family that much. I wanted to be with my friends.
Uh-huh.
But I was kind of trapped there, and it was for a long time.
Right.
And so, you know, it was the exact opposite of all the excitement of the Olympics. There was just nothing to do, and I was trapped on this island.
Right. So you're saying that you were heading back for your second year at San Jose State at this point?
Sorry?
You were heading back for your second year at San Jose State at this point then?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you got back to San Jose State, did you happen to run into Carlos and Smith or any of the people that were involved? Did they go back to San Jose State? Was Dr. Edwards involved with much on campus at that point? Do you remember?
You know, I don't remember anything like that.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I realized at that point that, you know, that all those guys who I'd known before, too, that they went to the same school. But then, of course, when they won all those medals and then all the controversy afterwards, you know, that really thrust them into the spotlight.
Right. Did the craziness of those days continue when you got back to, because this would be like 1968, 69 now.
Now it was 69. The games were in October of 68. Uh-huh. And so the semester started, I think, in middle of January of 69. So, you know, I just was out that semester of school, and then I picked it up again.
So you mentioned earlier the craziness of the tear gas canister and stuff. Did that continue when you got back to San Jose?
I don't remember it continuing. Well, one thing I think, I'm a little fuzzy on the timing here, but I remember there was a big demonstration in Berkeley, and somebody got killed by the National Guard, and it was a big deal.
Okay.
It really affected a lot of the students and people I knew. So, yeah, there was still some stuff going on.
Okay. And then so
but not so much at our school, I don't think.
Right. And you mentioned you pretty much, at that point, had started giving up on competitive cycling. Or wait,
I was very involved in it.
That was later after the 70s.
Yeah, I didn't let go of it until it was actually right before the 72 Olympics. I had to make a decision on whether I was going to try and make the team or not.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I had a pretty good chance of making the team, and I'd actually raced in Europe the the year before when I won the world, and I had also competed on a race that was in Germany, that was on the actual course that was going to be used in the Munich Olympics. So I had a good idea of what lay ahead. But I knew again that, you know, we weren't going to be competitive against the Europeans. Right. What happened is I won a race. It was a pretty big race at the time in Northern California. It was a 2-day stage race, and the prize was a trip to Italy. So that was a big prize back then.
Right, yeah, I'm sure.
It wouldn't be much now, but... So I went to Italy, and I knew some people there, and I was staying with them and racing in northern Italy, which is really a good area to be in for the level of competition. And that's when I rode the Worlds, and then went up to Germany and rode this race on the what was going to be the course for the Olympic road race, and rode a lot of other races too. And with an eye of like, well, could I make a living at this? Could I be a professional? And
right.
I actually trained with some professionals too, and that's when I decided, wow, this is a really hard life. I mean, back then it was really not much money in the sport, a fraction of what's there today. And the typical pro, would wash out after 2 years. And most of the guys didn't even make enough being on a major team to live on. They in fact had to have another job.
Uh-huh.
So they might do a 135 mile training ride in the morning and then go work in a factory in the afternoon. I just thought, wow.
Yeah.
I don't think this is for me.
So what made the decision of to try for the Olympics or not one more time?
Well, so I kind of realized what a hard life was going to be if I wanted to pursue the sport, and but I still thought, well, it might be neat to be on the Olympic team one more time. And then what happened is an opportunity came up where somebody I knew somebody who it was actually the executive director for Zero Population Growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know that organization?
I've heard of it, yeah.
And they were just kind of starting out back then. But anyway, Zero Population Growth wanted to sponsor some riders to ride across the United States and then go do some publicity at the Munich Olympics. And for some reason, when I heard that, I thought that might be more fun than training and being in the Olympics.
Uh-huh.
You know, just to ride my bike across the country is something I always wanted to do and get paid for it. And then to, go to the Olympics and promote the cause of Zero Population Growth, which I already was a member. I thought it was a pretty good organization. I liked their ideas. So I wound up doing that and expressed an interest, and they hired me and a couple of friends. And so that's what I did instead of trying out for the Olympic team.
Right. So
that's kind of how I ended my career.
So you did ride across the U.S., and did you attend the Olympics then at Munich?
Yeah,
okay.
I did, and although I wasn't there when the Israeli athletes were murdered, I had to go back and start grad school.
Uh-huh.
But I heard about it, and it was pretty horrifying.
Right.
But, I enjoyed being at the 72 games, and, a lot of my friends from the 68 team were there, and I had my old Olympic warm-up so I could just put them on. I took my bike over there and I had my bike, and so I could ride it right into the Olympic Village, no questions asked, and hang out with the guys, so that was kind of fun.
Yeah, they didn't check for a badge or anything, they just saw the outfit. That's funny.
And I realized that, because it was much more low-key,
Uh-huh.
This was before anything had happened.
Right.
And, and I realized, I was really glad to not have the pressure of being in training for the Olympics. And I felt good about my decision to drop out of competitive cycling.
Well, that's what matters.
And I was looking forward to going to grad school.
So. Right. Well, that's what matters the most, that you are content with your choice. So that's good.
Yeah.
All right. So last couple questions here. Looking back on the 68 Olympics, how do you think it impacted your life? You know, what effects do you think it had on you long term? And then what do you think it had on impact as far as like other the world? Like, did what was its legacy, do you think?
Yeah. Well, in terms of, for me personally, I guess one thing I got from it was maybe it was more the games or making the team than actually being in the Olympics. But yeah, I guess it's part of being in the Olympics too. It's just like just to not ever count yourself out, you know, like I achieved something that I never in my wildest dreams thought would ever happen.
Right.
And so I've never forgotten that, you know, that, you know, just because something might look difficult or even hopeless doesn't mean it can't be done. Because, you know, people can surpass themselves. People can do things they don't think they can do.
Uh-huh.
And I know it because it happened to me. So that was an important lesson.
And that's a good lesson to learn early on.
Good lesson to learn early and, yeah. You know, a good lesson to pass on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a son who's 28 now and, you know, I think I've passed that on to him.
That's good. Okay. What advice would you give somebody who was trying to be an Olympic athlete or wanting to pursue that?
Well, you know, it would just depend on the person. I mean, obviously you've got to take a look, you know, I believe, like most people do, that, you know, if you're going to engage in sport on that level, you've got to have a lot of natural talent. You've got to have a lot of drive and discipline, and you've got to put it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way sports are now, and including cycling, which, you know, really wasn't that way that much back then, because there's just so much more science to it, and,
uh-huh.
You know, there's a lot more knowledge about nutrition, training methods, massage. It's just way more sophisticated than in my day. And so, you know, I've never coached anybody because my knowledge is pretty obsolete.
Right.
But, you know, I just tell people that, you know, if you want to go after it, you've got to have all of those things. You've got to be really good. You've got to be really talented.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have a real desire to do well. You've got to be really focused. And you have to be very committed. It's just a huge effort.
You mentioned your son earlier. Did he take up any sports or cycling himself? Or?
Yeah, interestingly enough, he hasn't.
Okay.
He's he has completely different interests.
Okay. I was just curious if that had been passed on at all or because of your background, if he was interested in it also.
Yeah. No, I always hoped that he would.
Uh-huh.
But I never pushed him in any way. You know, and he played soccer when he was a kid, and
right.
You know, I'd go out and I was assistant soccer coach a couple times, and
uh-huh.
I'd go to his games, and but I never knew much about soccer, so I couldn't really help him that much in that way. And he kind of enjoyed it, you know, from the camaraderie, but he never had kind of the drive that I had to really excel in a sport.
Okay. Well, we're pretty much wrapping it up here. Is there anything that you may have thought of that you want to add or any questions you have for me maybe?
Well, I don't think so. I mean,
okay.
It's possible something might come to mind later and I could call you or email you back.
Yeah, I know that, well, I'm going to go ahead and stop the tape at this point.
Okay.
And so I'm just going to thank you on tape right now. But thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm.